glad that here in Queensland, at least, our government is trying to promote good standards. This is what we have tried to do. And it's not so long ago I was asked on the radio in Canberra, when Joe was down there for the last Premier's Conference, actually, one of the radio stations down there rang me and asked, "Why do you think, Mrs. Peterson, that Queensland's a good state to live in?" So, of course, my first answer was that it had a good Premier. You see? Perhaps I might be a little biased in that way. And then I said I felt we had a good government. And then I said that we are trying to maintain good standards here in our state of Queensland. And this is something that we know that Mrs. Whitehouse is doing her very best to help us with here in Australia. And so we're very glad indeed, Mrs. Whitehouse, to have you come here to meet us today, to talk to us, and to explain to us just exactly what you're working at. We know too that the Reverend Fred Nile with the Festival of Light, he also has an organisation that is most anxious to improve standards. As a matter of fact, I cut out the aims of the Festival of Light, and I have no doubt that Mr. Nile himself will be speaking perhaps about this afterwards. But when you look at them, to mobilise Australians in support of purity, love and family life, to proclaim the value of Christian standards of behaviour for family and community life, to persuade national and community leaders to strengthen the family as a basic unit of society, to resist influences that lower moral standards and threaten human dignity, to research the social implications of biblical ethics and the effects of modern trends on family and community life. They indeed are very worthwhile aims, and I'm very glad indeed to be able to be here associated with a meeting that has that in mind. And you know, ladies and gentlemen, when you see some of the statements that came out in the Human Relationships Commission report, then I feel that it's need for us to stand up and be counted when it comes to trying to improve the standards of our life here in Australia and in Queensland. When you can read that in their Human Relationships Commission report, that they advise that contraceptives and abortion should be freely available to girls of 14 years and over without parental consent. When you read that abortion should be permissible up to 22 weeks of pregnancy, that unmarried couples should not be refused permission to adopt children, well, I wonder what sort of a home that would get them into. Then I could read you the whole lot, but I won't. That homosexuality be decriminalised and accepted in schools and by society. Well, I wonder what we're coming to. When I was younger, you didn't mention things like that. But now people talk about it the whole time. And I wonder whether our growing young people don't begin to wonder whether that's the normal type of life. This is what worries me. And then I could go on, and they recommend that incest be decriminalised. And things like this. Well, this is the Human Relationships Commission report. And is it any wonder that we're very glad to have somebody like Mrs. Whitehouse come to Australia to put a good Christian point of view, what we think should be for our children and our children's children. As a mother and as a grandmother, I'm certainly glad to have you here, Mrs. Whitehouse, and I'm sure that the gathering here today is very glad that you've come, and we're looking forward to hearing from you. So, Mrs. Joyner, I think Mr. Nile might be going to say a few words now by way of telling us a little bit more about the Festival of Light and whether perhaps also perhaps about the 1979 Child Care, Not Child Abuse, the International Year of the Child, 1979. I wonder, did you see on television last night Mrs. Vilma Ward, I think it was, who was explaining all the different declaration of the rights of the child? Well, I watched it, and I've also got this here now, as you probably have today also. And I can't see that the rights of the child should be any different next year than as in a good Christian family, that we would automatically give our children the rights as set out here. I'm just not quite sure why.
Thank you.
So I'm not quite sure what extra rights our children are going to have. That's what I'd like to know. And I sometimes think that the rights that they ought to have sometimes are a good something on the behind if they don't do what they ought to. But ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to introduce to you now the Reverend Fred Nile, who is the director of the Festival of Light, and I'm sure we all appreciate the work that the Festival of Light has been doing here in our country of Australia. Thank you, Nile. I'm sure you've all been glad to hear from Mr. Nile about the tour that he and Mrs. Whitehouse have been doing throughout Australia. And I was particularly interested, ladies and gentlemen, to know that the Premier of West Australia, Sir Charles Court, had taken an active part in Mrs. Whitehouse's meetings. I would just like to say that Joe himself would have liked to have been associated with this too, I'm sure, but he has a few problems on his plate at the moment, as you might have read in the paper, and he is a very busy man just these next couple of days, and so it's just not possible for him to do this, Mrs. Whitehouse, but I'm sure he sends you his good wishes and his greetings. And I thought perhaps you might like to know that our lady on the far right is Dr. Jean McFarlane, the Director of Child Health and Welfare in our government in Queensland. We're very glad indeed, Jean, that you've come along here too. And Mr. McLean, who is Director of Community Standards Organisation on the far left. You'd all know Mrs. Joyner, of course. And then we have representatives from the churches here today. We're very glad indeed to welcome them and the WCTU. And I'm pleased too to see Lady Salento sitting here in front of me, and Gabby Horan. There are just so many of my friends around here today that it's just lovely to see you all, taking an interest in the need for good moral standards. And thinking about Sunday school, as Mr. Nile was just speaking, it just reminded me of what I've said on just so many occasions, ladies and gentlemen. We know, don't we, how our children need spiritual training. This is just so very important. And I've said so many times that if you don't send your children to school, what happens? The police come after you. The police inquire, why haven't you sent your children to school? If you don't send your children to Sunday school or to church, be it as it may, does anybody worry about you? No, they couldn't care less. And I sort of feel that the training that they receive from church and from Sunday school, this is a training for eternal life. One thing is sure, that our life on this earth is going to come to an end sooner or later. That's quite sure. And if you haven't done anything to prepare yourself and your children as the part of your family unit for a future life, well then I'm afraid it's rather unfortunate for them and for you. That's as far as I see it. And so I want to say this, and I must really introduce our guest of honour to you, because we've come to hear Mary Whitehouse speak to us today about child care, not child abuse. We thank you for coming, Mrs. Whitehouse, and we look forward with a great deal of pleasure to hearing what you're going to say to us.
The awful bit about this television business, and I'm so glad you're here actually, is that I can't see you. At least I can't see anybody outside the lights. But I know you're there. Mrs. Peterson, honoured guests, ladies and gentlemen. The last time I was in Sydney, no, there you are. That's what comes of chasing at great speed around the whole country. Half the time you don't know where you are. The last time I was in Brisbane, as I was reminded by one or two friends here this morning, lacked the sense of, dignity and composure which I sense here this morning. I ran into an airport strike, an electricity strike, a postal strike, and I finally took off from Brisbane to go to Sydney in one of those tiny little, well, it seems so tiny to me, little Cessna aeroplanes that set off for Sydney and halfway there decided he wasn't quite sure he'd got enough petrol to get there. So we'd go down at Port Macquarie and refuel. And when we got down at Port Macquarie and taxied up to the one little petrol pump at the end, there was an electricity strike as well, so there was no petrol. Right. Next year I'm going to write another book. And one of the stories I'm going to put in is the story of my last visit, not to mention this visit, to Australia. On a number of occasions, people have said to me, people I've met in, phone-in programmes, and a suggestion has been made, as it were, who do I think I am, coming to Australia and telling Australians what to do. Now, I promise you, ladies and gentlemen, that that's the last thing that I've come here for. I would agree that such a motive would be totally improper. But I would only say this, that if in 15 years of campaigning, we back home have learnt anything about the forces, about the motivation, about the identity of the people who are opposed, not just at all to me as a person, but are opposed to any movement to protect the child, to maintain the family, then that is a knowledge that we would want to share with all who are concerned. And the fact of the matter is, if you'll allow me to say so, is that no matter how good and stable a situation you have in the state of Queensland, we live in a very, very small world. A very, very small world. And I know of no reason why this great country of Australia should assume that it will be less prone to the kind of attacks which have come on Britain and upon America and of course in Europe. I know of no reason. In fact, I would say one perceives every reason. And therefore, if I'm arriving before you have these problems, then maybe what we have learned will be of some help to you. I should, however, confess straight away that I was amazed at what I found in South Australia. There is already an open sale with unrestricted label. The type of boy photograph magazine, which we have never had an open sale in Britain. Never. But it's there. And I thought to myself, I was told that Australia didn't really have these problems. Certainly, it seems to me there are parts of Australia when the problem actually exists and perhaps people don't even know. And I want to, before I talk very specifically about this, may I just share with you the essence of what one has come to understand over these 15 years about the nature of the battle, and that word I use carefully because battle it is, in which we are involved. When I started 15 years ago, I was what we call back in Britain senior mistress in a large mixed school. I was the senior woman on the staff next to the headmaster, and in that capacity I was, quote, responsible for the moral welfare of the girls. So that anything that happened with the children, and particularly with the girls, was very much my responsibility. Now, I imagine that perhaps some of you, at least here, will have some idea of the things I'm just going to mention to you. You may not be aware that they all happened the same year. In 1963, we had the Profumo scandal, which brought down the government. We had the publication of Dr. John Robinson's Honest to God, which produced the headlines, God is dead, man has come of age, you know, all this business, situational ethics, no such thing as right and wrong, you just decide for yourself according to the circumstances what you do. Three nights a week we had David Frost and his late night satire shows, and every Wednesday night we had something on television called the Wednesday Play, generally grouped together as kitchen sink drama. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I had a home, I had a husband, I had a family, and I'd gone back into teaching because our eldest child was just going to university. Therefore, I was a fully occupied woman, if I may put it that way. And no way was I seeking to prove anything. And most certainly I was not, as been sometimes suggested, that I was one of these middle-aged women complete with blue rinse and butterfly spectacles, sitting at home twiddling her thumbs and wondering what she'd do with her spare time. Not at all. But it became abundantly clear to me from not only what one saw through the media coverage of this kind of thing, and what was happening in hard political terms in our country, but because during the summer term of 1963, I had to deal with five different things that happened amongst the children. All of them were serious, two of them were very serious indeed. And as I talked over what had happened with the children and their parents, in every case, the spark of what had happened came from something that had been seen or heard on television. Now, I'm not in the business of running an anti-television campaign. And may I say this, and I say it without deference to the fact that we have television cameras here this morning, I am in no doubt, certainly as far as the scene is concerned back home, that the approach of the television medium to many of these issues today would have been totally different, far more responsible. Be that as it may, here I was, in the summer of 1963, faced with the most stark evidence that unless something could be done about the values that were being propagated without any kind of authority, but just by virtue of being able to use the media in one way or another, no way could I fulfill the obligations which are laid on me as regards the children. The year before, we, Britain, had published a government report on the future of education. It hasn't been superseded. It's still there. The most prestigious educational report for 20 years. And about sex education, it said this: sex instruction must be given on the basis of chastity before marriage and fidelity within it. But I saw that any attempt, whether I was a Christian or I wasn't a Christian, that was a responsibility professionally laid on me. And it was impossible. No way was I, as an individual teacher, going to be able to resist what was happening through the media and through the people who were creating the news for the media. So it seemed to me that unless something could be done about television, I and countless other parents and teachers were fighting a losing battle. Now, I tell you that to give you something of the background. Here I come, right into the heart of your city. What right have I be here? By what reason do I stand where I am? Well, that was the beginning of it. And I had no experience, no understanding of the media, of public life. I was terrified of the papers. I've learned to have a good deal of respect for them since, I may say. And very grateful for a great deal they have done, particularly in relation to the latest aspect of child abuse. But you see, ladies and gentlemen, since that day, 15 years later, what do I see? I started with a deep and personal concern for a few hundred children for whom I was responsible. I come to you today with this message to you. There are two main forces at work in the whole of this destructive scene of pornography, whether it's child pornography or anything else. The attack upon the Christian values, the attack upon the establishment. Now, I'm not saying the establishment doesn't have to change, but reasoned discussion is the thing to take place. So you get one view balanced by another, etc. Now, what does one see? On the one hand, one sees the power of a multi-million pound industry. Now, that is the pornography industry. In some instances, mafia-related, certainly in many instances, drug-related. Right? Now, when you have an industry as powerful as that industry, you know perfectly well they are going to use absolutely every weapon at their disposal, as advertisers and commercial people with something to sell will always do. That is why, ladies and gentlemen, if you're going to get involved in this issue, you have got to be prepared to be misrepresented, to be ridiculed, to have almost a massive conditioning of people to say, no, we don't really want anything to do with them. They're really rather extreme, aren't they? You know, fuddy-duddies and all this kind of thing. And so the average person thinks, well, no, 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 no. So you've got the power of this mass media. And while I'm saying this, may I tell you this? You perhaps know that in this last summer, that's your last winter, we were instrumental, along with other groups, of getting onto the statute book in Britain a protection of the child bill, which deals with precisely, ladies and gentlemen, the kind of photograph that I saw so freely available in South Australia. It is now illegal in Britain to sell, to produce, to distribute any photograph of a new child under the age of 16 or any person who appears to be under the age of 16. I should tell you that it's very clearly defined that the kind of photographs that grandma or grandpa takes of the little naked baby, we're not talking about that. We're talking of the bill deals with the commercialization of these things. Now, that is illegal. And the bill does not actually talk about child pornography. The word pornography never comes in. That bill has started at a much higher level. It deals with the indecent photographs of children. So before you get to the child pornography thing, we have dealt with the indecent photographing and distributing photographs of children. Now, that bill now exists in Britain. And those purveyors of child pornography will have no outlet in Britain anymore. We had over to Britain for our campaign, we brought over to Britain Dr. Judy Denson-Garber, who you had over here to talk about drugs. She came over to Britain, and she came for a week before the most important parliamentary debate. And while she and I were together, that first Monday afternoon, she had a phone call from Washington to say the president had just signed their child pornography bill in the States. And their child pornography bill is infinitely more stronger than ours. Infinitely stronger. But now you have a situation where child pornography and child indecency is illegal in the United States of America and in Great Britain. Do you think that the pornographers are going to pack up and go home and say, oh, well, good while it lasted? No way. No way. They're going to look for new markets. And if you already have this in South Australia, as you do, how can you have an absolute assurance that with no customs barriers between your states, that there aren't going to be the people who bring it up in their private cars and the rest? I don't know. You answer that question, not me. And what has been so interesting back home is this, that over this 15 years, when we have campaigned on almost immovable issues, for instance, we have said, if you constantly portray violence as normal on the television screen, you will help to create a violent society. We said that 15 years ago, and we've never moved. We've gone on saying it and saying it. And all during those years, it's almost difficult now. I don't get ridiculed in Britain these days. I don't. It's almost impossible now in Britain to realise that 15 years ago we were ridiculed, well, immeasurably and endlessly, for saying things that were perfectly, in our terms, common sense. Now, a fortnight before I came away, the British government have published its white paper on broadcasting. And they have said in that white paper, word for word, what we have been saying through these 15 years. Right up to the publication of that white paper, the official attitude of the broadcasting authorities, and indeed the sort of minister responsible for broadcasting, was this. All right, we have a great social problem of increased violence. I don't know about yours, But back home, figures for violent crime are increasing 12.5% per year. And most of those crimes are carried out by young people below the age of 20. Young people who've been brought up soaked with the idea that violence must be okay because mum and dad sit there and we have it on the television screen while we're having our meals. Why should we think that each other are okay? And we have said, they have worked on the assumption that until there is proof that television violence affects, then we have to assume that it doesn't. Now, what's the white paper say? The government is telling the broadcasters, you must work on the assumption that television violence does help to create social violence until there's proof that it does not. And that is precisely the thing that we've been working for. Sex. What has been our position about that as far as television? You know, we've been ridiculed as fuddy-duddy and all this. But what we have been saying is this, that if you turn sex into a spectator sport on television, if you feed out the idea night after night, the boy meets girl and automatically they get into bed together. This is a normal, natural thing. You will so desensitize human relations, the care that one person has for another in that particular field. You will, and I know this to be true, that if you portray on television a certain kind of sexual behavior as normal, you will have not only youngsters, but you will have adult people who are given the norm of performance, if you'll forgive the word. And if somehow they don't live up to that, then there's somehow something not quite right about me or how I do it, if you'll allow me to put it that way. And it's the whole desensitization in this field. It is the commercialization of sex, which we have been so much against. Now, what has happened? A bit at a time, and this is another thing, allow me to say to you, it is a bit at a time that a society becomes conditioned to accept. What shocked people 6 months ago, I am meticulous that knowing what hardcore pornography is, I do not look at it again. I am as capable of having my judgment corrupted as anybody else is. And I keep away from the stuff, but I know what it is. And when you have a situation where a bit at a time, language used on television and a row, language used again on television, not so much of a row, language used again on television and nobody says anything about it. And all the fields, that's how it goes on. And we have moved through the portrayal of normal sex, through the portrayal of sadistic sex, through the portrayal of bestiality, of all these things. But when the country suddenly realized that the next step was the use of the child, I tell you that the whole of Britain, the media, broadcasting, television, radio, the papers, everybody joined together and the people, and we said, thus far and no further. But ladies and gentlemen, did we have a great problem of child pornography? No, not at all. Because we knew what was happening in Europe and what was happening in America. We didn't wait for a problem. As soon as we saw it filtering through under the counter in Soho, we said we move. And that was how we moved. And that was the basis. And the government didn't actually want to do anything about it. But in the end, we had a petition of what? 1.6 million. We got it in 3 months. And it represented 99.96% of everybody who'd signed. No way can a government resist that. And with all that's happening on the political scene back home, the government said, we will make time for a bill. And it was on the statute book in 9 months. One of the quickest bills ever. But I have to tell you, we didn't wait for the problem. Because we know so well that once the stuff begins to get about, no way can you stop it. No way can you stop it. So, now there are so many things thoughts I perhaps might leave with you. I told you, for instance, that when I was teaching, I was involved in the field of sex education. And people have said to me, what should we look out for? What are the danger signs? Well, could I share some of these with you? One of our sources of much controversy about sex education in schools have been the activities of the Family Planning Association. It is a very different body now to what it was when it started, when it had a lot of support from the Christian Church and so on. If I can just read a short, this is the British Medical Journal, 29th of July this year, and this is signed by, amongst other people, John Peel, who was the Queen's gynaecologist. And they refer to one booklet, which has been freely distributed by the FPA in schools in Britain. Now, the FPA are an international body. They're not a British body, they're international. And they have a magazine, a paper, which was distributed in the schools, called Learning to Live with Sex. It talks about sexual intercourse in terms of boys and girls. 6 full pages on contraceptive methods, 10 lines on responsibility, which is equated almost entirely with the use of contraceptives. There is no section on marriage. It does not mention the positive health and social advantages of self-control, and so on. So that is a possibility of those of you who are involved in care. I'm not saying you've got a problem, but these are the leads that you might follow. You might also watch out for those who are now actively demanding a lowering, if not a doing away altogether, with the age of consent. And once you get that, ladies and gentlemen, I mean, forgive me, but allow me to read just this. This is Judy Denson Gerber's submission to the Senate in the USA. She says that she is an attorney and a doctor and a psychiatrist, and she said that in Connecticut, 2 cases of gonorrhea of the throat in children under 18 months of age, and 1 in a child under 9 months of age. Now, I don't have to elaborate on how the child got gonorrhea of the throat. But once you destroy the protection that society gives to its children, you will put the whole of your children at risk. The whole of your children at risk. And I want to share with you what I feel most passionately. That a society that ceases to care for its young and puts the welfare of its young before lining its pockets, before anything else at all, has a death wish upon it. Because the children are the future. And this brings me to the second of the 2 forces which we have seen at work in this whole scene. On the one hand, what I call the dirtiest face of capitalism. On the other hand, those ideological forces who know that without the foundation of the Christian faith, without sound family life, without a coming on generation which is protected by society, there will grow up a generation totally at risk and totally at the mercy of subversives and ideologues. Do you know what I'm talking about? There's a very interesting thing that the communists said immediately after the end of the last war. Britain, and don't forget, they said this at a moment when Britain had shown that whatever the cost, we would fight to the death. We were not to be frightened into submission. No end to the sacrifice we were prepared to make. And it became abundantly clear that there was no way of conquering Britain that way. But the communists said this, and I quote, Britain is the kingpin of the West. The West will never fall till Britain falls. And ladies and gentlemen, I can make no sense of what has happened in Britain in the last 30 years, unless I take that into consideration. And when you actually look, if you look even at the groups which have opposed me in my visit here, ask who they are. ask who their what their affiliations are, and you come to the heart of the matter. So we're not engaged in a battle between your good taste and my good taste. We're actually engaged in a battle for the whole of the future of democracy. Because democracy cannot work unless the people within it are truly free. And unless the character of the people within that democracy is such that they will make personal sacrifices and accept personal limitations for the greater good of society as a whole. Now that is what democracy is all about. As you subvert that, and you bring up a generation to believe that what I want, I should be able to have because I want it. That doesn't take us back to the Victorian days. It takes us back to pre-civilization days. Pre-civilization days. And I touch here on what I know is a sensitive subject in Australia, but this I must do. You make up your own mind about what I say, but may I share these things with you? I know there's the pressure here for the legalisation of homosexual relations between adults. We have had that law, and it was passed by people who were genuinely enlightened, who felt it was a genuinely compassionate thing to do. We've had that law for 10 or 11 years. Now, I don't want to enter into a controversy about that law back in Britain, but what I can tell you is what has happened since that may be of some help to you. That as soon as they legalised homosexual practices between adults, then what's next? It's 21 and up at home. Pressure, lower it to 18. Pressure, lower it to 16. Pressure to get rid of it altogether. And following that, the homosexual groups have sought continuously the right to get into the schools. And it is there, ladies and gentlemen, that I draw issue. It's not for me to stand in judgment about what two people decide themselves to do. Not back in Britain, where we already have a law. But when I see them going into schools and engaging in what, to me, is one of the most total acts of repression that anybody could engage in, then I fight. And what is that total act of repression? It's this. They go into the schools to talk to the adolescent children. And anybody with understanding of the adolescent development knows that there is something that is officially called by psychiatrists the homosexual phase. This is when the girls takes a bunch of flowers to the head of the school. The boy wants to whiten the cricket boots of the head of the cricket team, the captain of the cricket team. That is a perfectly normal phase on the route to heterosexuality. But if you go into or allow people to go into schools and say to these vulnerable and confused 13, 14, 15, 16 year olds that to be gay is wonderful, that when you're gay, then you reach the ultimate in human sexual experience. What you are doing is imprisoning the young in what is a very, very immature part or section of their development. Now that's where I fight, and I tell you that these are the things which will happen here. No, if I say that, it sounds as though I'm telling you not to do it because you've got to do what to do. I mean, I simply tell you, that is what happened back in Britain. And my final word, it is this. Oh, no. Can I read this? The night before I left Britain on another one of these visits, I saw, and I don't know whether you had it here in Australia, but if you haven't, try and get it. I saw the remarkable interview with Alexander Solzhenitsyn on BBC television. Have you ever had it? And you know, the press and the media were told he was coming. They were sworn to silence. That man came into Britain, did that interview, was taken away again to his hideout, and nobody knew till he was safely back. So no way can he go on saying these things. But there was one thing especially he said that night that in my mind when I heard him, I sort of promised him that every time I got a chance to pass on that message of his, I would do it. And he said this, and it's the heart of the matter. He says, Western listeners will find my words embarrassing. Good use of the word, that's embarrassing. But I would say this, he said. Those people who have lived in the most terrible conditions on the frontier between life and death, be it people from the West or from the East, they all understand that between good and evil there is an irreconcilable contradiction. That good and evil are not one and the same thing. That one cannot build one's life without regard to this distinction. And the fact of the matter is that in the whole of the Western world, we are asked to build our life without regard to that distinction. But my final word is this, and it's a word of great hope, and it's a word of joy. We got involved in all this before you did. Therefore, we're in a way a few years, I think, ahead of you. You may have yet to go through a good deal of what we've been through. But I have this to say to you, and it's a word of great hope. I always felt, I suppose it was my time, I spent my whole life with youngsters really, I always had a sense in my heart that if we could hold the fort long enough, that a generation of children would grow up who would do what the young have always done, rebel against the establishment. We've always done that. We haven't always done it violently. We haven't always done it the way it's being done now. But we have always, you know, looked at our parents' values and said, oh, well, you know. Now, the permissive society is the establishment in Britain, right? But there is now a generation of young people, and I see this particularly in the universities, who are rebelling against the permissive society. Do you know what's dawning on them? What is absolutely true? That the permissive society, supposed to be in the name of freedom for the young, was never the idea of the young. It was the product of the middle-aged entrepreneur, the trendy cleric, the left-wing intellectual, and it was laid upon the young. But the young look at our society, these escalating figures for violent crime, for venereal disease, for broken homes, for mental ill health, you name it, we've got it. And they look at it and they say, we don't like it. What are we going to do about it? And I tell you this, what is happening is that not only are they rebelling in a negative kind of way, but they are finding against themselves a real experience of the Christian faith. And when I was, my most memorable of wonderful experiences, when I debated last year in Cambridge University, now that's a debating chamber if you like, packed, all of galleries full, sitting on the floor or around your feet and so on, and we were debating the motion that pornography is the exploitation of decadence. And at Cambridge, two students support the motion before the main speaker. And the young man who got up to speak first, splendid, splendid looking young fellow, very handsome, very healthy looking, obviously very clever, he wouldn't have been there at all. And a brilliant debater, you know, you've got to kind of get your people like this. And he got them there. And then all of a sudden, his whole mood changed. And he lifted up his arm like an Old Testament prophet, the New Testament prophet. He swept it round that uni. And he thundered out. But I say unto you, he said, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are of good report, think on these things, he said. And ladies and gentlemen, I lowered my head and I shut my eyes. I thought they'll crucify him. I thought they were crucified. But I looked up, and that union was just a sea of shining young faces hanging on his every word. The fact that we won the debate by about 3-1 is neither here nor there. But afterwards, I said to the president, I said, that was an extraordinary experience. Well, he said, not really, Mrs. Weinfeld. He said, that union is full every Thursday night for Bible study. Marvellous. Thank you. I'm told that the fact that is this working?
I don't think you need to say it now. I think just quite
yes.
Just say a question about sex education.
Well, you heard. I've got to say the question.
Just briefly.
The question about sex education.
Preschool
sex education. They're recording it all. See, they only hear my answer and they don't know the question. That's what I've got to do. I have two reactions really to this, and you're not alone in this. Of course, this is exactly the kind of thing that's happening everywhere. First of all, it is a great intrusion into parents' rights. I think that is very important. The other thing is this, and it was one of the things that we learnt when we were doing sex education. Children have maybe of the same physical age, but there's a vast disparity of emotional development. And if you give information to one child, it may be okay. To another one, it can be intensely damaging. Not only are they of a different emotional development, they also have different backgrounds. And you don't know, you can't know, whether the child is laying awake at night wondering what on earth all those noises that they can hear through the walls and perhaps the anger and even the crying and the rest of it. You know, it's a terrible intrusion. It's an intrusion into parents' rights and it's an intrusion into the child's rights. And I'll tell you something that was said by one of the most eminent American psychiatrists, child psychiatrists, and she says this, that if you intrude into, with sexual material, into the child's early life, then you can create, right from the beginning, very serious psychological damage. Now, having said that, I am not saying that young children shouldn't have their questions answered. It is immensely important that all children, whether they're preschool or whatever, I mean, children can start asking, especially mummy's having a baby, you know, what's the lumpy mummy's, it doesn't matter who put it there and so on. And if you're a sensitive parent, as most are, you answer that. And if the schools want to do something constructive in this, let them get the parents together. That's what we did. We got the parents. We even got some fathers. I was very pleased about that. We got the parents together. And we helped them to be able to talk to their own children. But you cannot reduce sex to something that happens on a Tuesday morning between 10:30 and 11. It just is not on. And if I were in Australia, I would fight that like mad. But I'm not, so I'll leave it to you.
Question from Mrs. Brooks, and then one from Mrs. Horne.
Mrs. Whitehouse, through you, Madam Chairman, it seems to me, I will ask the question, but I just want to put the record straight, it seems to me that actually in having a year of a child, the children are being exploited. Now, I look to the background, the sponsors of the year of a child. Already in China last week at a huge meeting of women, it was decided that the child belongs to the state and not to the family. And I feel that this year of the child will be exploited by the same ideologists who try to control us as next year. And until the United Nations has a year of the family, I treat the year of the child with great suspicion. And I would like to know if, I don't suppose we can change it to the year of the family. but I'm extremely concerned that the year of the child will be used to create great big child centres, care centres, where the state will take over. When the state takes over, the standards must drop.
Well, I sympathise very much with what you say.
And I don't think any way, as you suggest, is this going to be changed now. But you know, the real answer to that is not in a free democracy to stop these people saying what they're saying. It is for everybody else to make sure that the year of the child is the year of the child in the family situation. It is the countless millions who are so silent, who are afraid of doing anything. I mean, these groups are so tiny. They're so tiny, but the rest of us are terrified of speaking out. I don't know what it was, but we've got to. And that's really the answer. Because, you see, I see it also from another point of view. The child is terribly exploited. And in a sense, it's important that we do look at the way in which the child is being exploited. I mean, there are even those who are saying, if you talk about the family, I mean, I'm all the way with you there, but if you talk about the family, it's all right for the father to have incestuous relationship with his own child and the brother and sister, as we were hearing. We've got the year of the child. Let every single one of us, whether we're women's organisations, churches, whether we're a group of neighbours or whatever, make our voice heard, and the media will respond. But it's no good saying the media give all this publicity to this, that and the other. And that's all we say. We have got to make news too. And if we make news, then they'll pick it up and the whole climate of the year of the child will change. That's really the answer, I think.
Thank you, Mrs. Whitehouse. Now, I did ask Mrs. Horan had the call just before.
Madam Chairman, Mrs. Whitehouse, have you experienced in England a particular course that is endeavouring to become into the Australian schools at this moment, and this is the science of death, where they teach the children from the early age to look upon death as something, you're not frightened of it. Okay, none of us should be frightened of death, because if we're reasonable people, we have a chance of a better life. But at the same time, they are teaching the children what, to my way of thinking, and I think Mrs. Joyner and the other ladies here would say so too, is the first step to euthanasia. And that is where they say that death for an elderly person is a blessed relief and you get rid of them. Death for a child who's brought into the world through no fault of its own, maimed and disabled, the best thing to do is to get rid of it. Have you had any experience with that in Britain?
A question on whether we're getting in Britain the pressure towards euthanasia. And the answer to that must be yes. It was very interesting, in the year in which I spoke, about 1963, there was also launched in Britain a group called the British Humanist Association. The most membership it has ever had was 5,000. It's now down to 1,600 and something. But in 1962, they said they were going to campaign for abortion law reform, homosexual law reform, euthanasia, doing away with religious instruction in schools, doing away with Sunday observance. And they got homosexual law reform, and they got abortion law reform. The reason why they haven't got the other is because the rest of us have got going and made sure that they haven't. But I so agree with you. In a way, it's related to what I said before about a society having a death wish upon it. It's all part of it, that life is somehow about death, instead of being about life and hope. And if you can get rid of your old people, and you can get rid of all your weak and your frail people, well, we all know who tried to do that, don't we? Who? Hitler. It's a totalitarian society being wholly on the healthy and the fit and the young. And I'm glad to know that you're so aware of this and fighting it.
Yes, thank you. Now I'm only taking one more question. Thank you. I think you were up there. Now the lady behind you asked before.
I'd just like to maybe comment on the Family Planning Association. I think it's an association we should all be particularly interested in. tying it in with what Mrs. Whitehouse said on the Marxist feminist group of people, one of their big personalities in New South Wales, for example, is a girl called Penny Ryan, who was one Mr. Hayne's women's advisor, and she's now the New South Wales Family Planning Association person there, and she's a member of the Communist Party of Australia and has said so. So I think we should be terribly aware and educated of what that organisation
is. Very good.
Yes, thank you everybody, ladies and gentlemen. I actually did bring a paper with me that I've been going around Queensland quoting from for many, many years now. It was entitled Wake Up Australia, and it was written by Mrs. Hilary Russell of Jimbul, and she says all that is necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men, and I always add, and women do nothing. And then she goes on to say in 1919 the Russian rules for revolution were corrupt the young, get them away from religion, get them interested in sex, get control of all means of publicity, thereby get people's minds off their government by focusing their attention on athletics, sexy books and plays, and other trivialities. That is some of the rules for revolution that were published in 1919. And so we see, don't we, that we have to just be so careful, and I'm sure that we've enjoyed very much indeed hearing Mrs. Whitehouse speak to us today and bring these things to our notice. I'm going to ask Dr. Jean McFarlane if she would now move a vote of thanks to our guest speaker, please.
I'm sure on behalf of all of you, I say thank you very much, Mrs. Whitehouse. It's been like a breath of fresh air to hear somebody say what many of us for such a long time have been thinking about. I think we're inclined to think that the views of the average person don't get much notice taken of them. I've worked with Mr. George Cook for many years, and it was through him that I learned the power of the individual. And perhaps some of you are wondering how in your small circle you can do anything to change attitudes within the community. I think Mrs. Whitehouse is an example of how one individual can do very much. But Mr. Cook's philosophy is you take your pen in your hand and you write, and you write letters to members of Parliament at federal level and state level, and you say what you think. And I think there's a lot of truth in this particular piece of advice. I think maybe a lot of you should start writing letters saying what you think about many things, and particularly perhaps what you think about the forthcoming year of the child. You will remember a few years ago we had International Women's Year, and you will remember the many problems that came as a result of that. But I was in Scotland a few years ago, and I heard an American Scotch priest preacher, and he said that people said to him, what do we do about all these worrying kitchen sink dramas dragging the individuals down? What do we do about them? And his answer was that we use it as a challenge. We're not afraid of it. We use it as a challenge to find out what we ourselves think and to fight positively. Now, Mrs. Whitehouse is an excellent example to us all of how we fight positively. And I think in thanking Mrs. Whitehouse, we should also thank Mrs. Belkey-Peterson, because it's very pleasing to know that she will fight for what she believes in, just like her husband. So I'd ask you all to join with me in thanking Mrs. Whitehouse and Mrs. Peterson. Thank you.
Now, all that remains, ladies and gentlemen, is for you to enjoy your lunch. You've enjoyed hearing from Mrs. Whitehouse. I hope you'll all have a very happy luncheon all together.
Thank you.
Oh, Mr. Nile just has one announcement.
Just a quick item. Mrs. Whitehouse's new book is available on the table over there. It's called Whatever Happened to Sex? And, of course, it's not a sex education manual. It deals with the exploitation of sex. And we were prompted by the statement that Mrs. Peterson made about the communist plans. Mrs. Whitehouse has even a later set of information that deals with the same theme, and it's printed in this publication. There's a valuable amount of resource material in here. If you buy this book, you can prepare your own talks, quote the graphs, the charts, the figures. Mrs. Whitehouse has compiled a wealth of material and information, $3.95 on the bookstore. Don't forget the tapes of today's gathering are available for $3. $3? The tape man says $3. Okay? Buy them today and take them away.